We're just continuing in verse 8 of chapter 1. Paul writes, "First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for all of you, because your faith is proclaimed throughout the world. For God, whom I serve with my spirit by announcing the gospel of his Son, is my witness that without ceasing I remember you always in my prayers, asking that by God's will I may somehow at last succeed in coming to you. For I am longing to see you so that I may share with you some spiritual gift to strengthen you, or rather so that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that I have often intended to come to you, but thus far been prevented, in order that I may reap some harvest among you as I have among the rest of the Gentiles. I am a debtor both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to the wise and the foolish. Hence my eagerness to proclaim to the gospel to you also who are in Rome. For I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed through faith, for faith, as it is written, the one who is righteous will live by faith." Friends, this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Now, Paul is an interesting character, partly because we end up hearing more from Paul than we hear from Jesus in the New Testament. And Paul has, without a doubt, shaped the face and the history and the practice and the experience of the church in the intervening 1900 some odd years. That said, he's also very human. We get introduced to Paul the first time in the book of Acts when he is holding people's coats while the deacon Stephen is being stoned to death. And then he is kind of this terrifying boogeyman character for the church. He's coming to get you. He's coming to get you. He's on his way to Damascus to get the people who follow the way. And then Jesus intervenes. And you still have this moment where Ananias has to decide, do I really trust Jesus enough to go rescue Saul off the road and make him well? And then the 12 have to decide if they're going to take Paul in. And then if they're going to send Paul out and let him take the lead. And through most of Acts, Peter is actually the apostle to the Gentiles after that experience with Cornelius. And then he gets supplanted by Paul. And so Peter, the rock on which Christ will build his church, has to decide, okay, what are we going to do with this Paul character? Because he took my job, man. The rest of you had the Jews, and I had the rest of the world. It was a great, big, wide-open sales territory. Now I got to share it. And so Paul goes on multiple missionary journeys. He has a lot of great stories. He preaches so long that people fall out of windows because they fall asleep. Not sure that's a great recommendation for his preaching, but there you have it. And his goal is always to make it to Rome, to go to the seat of power, to go to the place of empire and proclaim that first Christian creed, which flies in the face of everything that Rome says when they say Caesar is Lord, and to say to them, Jesus is Lord. And so this is kind of his introduction letter to the church at Rome. It's already there. It's not a church he founds. It's not a church he starts. There are already faithful people, Christians in Rome. And we sort of get the feeling that Paul writes this because somebody has asked for his resume, his CV, his statement of faith. Before you come to town and we let you preach here, we want to know a little bit more about you, because we've heard all sorts of stories about you, Paul. As you can well imagine, they might have. And this passage today is just the opening of the letter, and yet I found it fascinating. We often portray Paul as a kind of egomaniacal, quasi-evil, narcissistic genius who's at the center of everything and has to be at the center of everything. What struck me is that Paul writes about how excited he is to be there with them. Not so that he can fix them. Not so that he can teach them something that he knows they've doctrinally gotten wrong already. But so that he can be there with them because his faith is strengthened by their faith. That they will be doing this thing together, that he prays for them and their successes, and that he hears about their faithfulness as a church as he travels. So let's put this into context for a moment. Let's pretend that your favorite church speaker is coming to town. For some of you, that's Billy Graham, deceased, but hey, we're pretending we can get away with almost anything. Maybe it's Walter Brueggemann, maybe it's Rachel Held Evans, maybe it's Katie Cannon, maybe it's Nadia Bolz Weber. Your favorite person is coming to town, and they're coming to Marion, and they're going to be here. I mean, that's pretty cool in and of itself, right? And then they send the session a letter, and they say, I am so looking forward to it. I've been hearing about you guys for years, and I just haven't been able to get there, and I can't wait to see what you have to share with me about this Jesus Christ that we worship together. We would have that thing framed. We'd have it posted in the newspaper. It'd be on the church website. I would give you all pocket laminated copies to hand out on the street. That is the equivalent of what this opening of Romans is. Imagine that. Just for a moment. Just briefly. That they were as excited to be here as we were excited to have them. Because I think that's how we have to use this lens to play with Rome and the letter to the church at Rome, is that Paul is not going in to fix them. He doesn't have a 12-step plan. He doesn't have a newly published book on how to make your church thrive in the shadow of empire. He does not have he's not even writing a book about how Christians can survive in the Colosseum against the lions. He just wants to be there with them. It's really powerful. So hear it again. After his introduction, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for all of you because your faith is proclaimed throughout the world. Without ceasing, I remember you always in my prayers. I'm longing to see you so that I may share with you some spiritual gift to strengthen you, or rather so that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's strength, by each other's faith, both yours and mine. Wow. That's not the Paul we usually hear, is it? It's not the Paul we think we usually hear. I think that's the challenge for us in approaching Romans. It's on many levels his most comprehensive theological work. We deal with the 8th chapter when it comes to Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation, and it's all Paul's fault then. The Catholics would even say that. If only he hadn't written chapter 8. We read chapter 11 in Sunday school this morning. And the thing that struck me that we so often forget about people we consider giants of the faith is that they know they're not doing it on their own. They know that it takes more. We often lose sight of that. We go soundbitey on passages. We pull out one verse at a time or one line from a sermon. But there's more to it than that. And so Paul in this passage is saying, you have something to tell me. You have something to teach me about what it means to be faithful. You guys remember the story of Paul. There's lots of stories of Paul. At one point on one of his journeys, he gets arrested because he is a rabble-rouser. We forget that Paul is not a good boy in the eyes of the state. He's a church rock star, but that creates problems. And he is about to be beaten, whipped. Now, we remember somebody else who was beaten and whipped by the authorities, right? I mean, that's part of our story. And you remember what Paul does? Pulls out his passport and says, you can't do this to me, I'm a citizen. Paul's an interesting character in conundrum. He has a powerful faith that sometimes he walks away from that moment, that instance of pain and suffering. Now, we don't ever get that passage where Jesus goes, you can't beat me, I'm the Son of God, but you know, that's why we're beating you. That's what you say. Paul is a person who has temporal power. He has earthly power. He has status. He has standing. He's a Pharisee. He was educated by Gamaliel. He went to all the right schools. He did all the right extracurriculars. He got into Phi Beta Kappa, whatever the first century AD equivalent is. He was in the fellowship of Jewish athletes. They kicked him out later. He had all the credentials, all the right things, and yet he writes to the church at Rome, to people he's never met, to people who live in the very shadow of Caesar's palace, that he has something to learn from them because he has been living his life in the protection of the shadow of Caesar's palace. And I think that's one of those things that we have lost track of, is how to say to one another in different and disparate churches, even inside our own church, I draw strength from your faith. And that's what struck me most reading the first chapter of Romans. Not excitement for everything that was going to come after, not the verses I know so well in chapter 8, that not heights nor powers nor principalities nor anything else in all creation can separate us from the love of God in Jesus Christ. It struck me that Paul knew he needed the body gathered and the body scattered to be his most faithful self. I think sometimes we lose track of that. We get, as we talked about in Sunday school this morning, we get competitive about church. They got more people. They got more money. They got young people. Talk about that like it's an endangered species. They have a better building. They have a better parking lot. They have a parking lot. They have a better preacher. They have a better preacher's wife. You know, whatever it is, we do that thing. And we lose sight of the fact that we're not all called to do the same thing. I was down at First Pres in Cape a couple weeks ago. Somebody's daughter who works for Marian Medical Mission conned me into going down there to do some Marian Medical Mission work. And as I was walking around their building, because I love being a church tourist, it's in downtown, it's two buildings attached in like three or four different ways. They had a picture that's up on the screen in the other room that it says, the church seeking the heart of God in the heart of the city. And I took a picture precisely because that was profound, and partly because I could make the argument that we're the church that moved to the edges to care for the people who live at the edges. That does not diminish the ministry of the church at the heart of the city. That does not diminish what the people of First Christian are doing across the street from the high rise and a block away from the Ministerial Alliance and three blocks off the square. That does not diminish what First Christian or First Methodist or First Baptist are doing. Because God knows there's enough need. But here we are, those crazy Presbyterians who abandoned downtown and moved way out here to the sticks, which is not quite the sticks anymore. Do we have the ability to celebrate that we are the people who moved to the edge, following a Christ who served the people on the edge? So that's what I was thinking about is, what is it we have to offer that's unique? What is it that Paul or your favorite contemporary theologian, public Christian, would come to say, man, they do this really well? Because yes, we have our foibles and we have our failings. We also do some things really well. And we started talking about that a little bit in Sunday school this morning, that one of the gifts of being a smaller church is all the ways in which things overlap. Because we're not big enough to have a separate age group class for the first graders and the second graders and the third graders and the fourth graders and the fifth graders. So they all get stuck together. And that means that your fourth grader sometimes has to help your one who doesn't read well yet. And that means that, Gayla, how many generations of kids have you dealt with as we would deal with generations of kids? You've been teaching that class, what, 11 years now? 12 years, more than that. I mean, she's been teaching since the troublesome martini boys were in that class. Okay? So, one of the things that we gain by having Gayla faithfully serve those kids for 9 months out of every year and then run for the hills every summer, is that our kids hear consistently the story of God revealed in Jesus Christ from someone who loves to tell that story to them. Not just like for a year and then like the next year there's a new teacher, but over the long haul. And believe it or not, they tell stories at home about what they heard in Sunday school from Gayla. Yes, oh God, indeed. Right? But that's not the only person we have who's taught Sunday school for more than a year or more than a week in this church, who's taught multiple generations of people who have cycled through, who have struggled with and asked others to help them pray and study Scripture and come to an understanding of what God is doing here and now. We have that gift. We have that gift that on Wednesday morning when we told our spiritual autobiographies, we had at one end of the table John Van Dyke in his 80s. Still just the tiniest hint of a Dutch accent and a larger serving of professorial expertise in there to tell the story of his life